8. That Saturday night, Jim Briskin was across the bay in Berkeley, at his mother's home on Spruce Street. With his key, he still kept a key to the white concrete house in which he had been born, he unlocked the basement door and began sorting among the stacks of boxes piled by the pipes of the furnace. The cement floor under his feet was cold. Spiderwebs had spread out over the jars and bottles along the window sills. At the far end of the basement was a combination washer-dryer, and that was new. He did not remember that. Among the clothes and magazines and furniture, he found the camping equipment. First, he carried the Coleman stove and lamp to his car, parked in the driveway, and then he gathered up the tent and took that, too. While he was inspecting the air mattresses, the door at the top of the stairs opened, and the stairs' lights came on. "It's me," he said, as his mother appeared. "I saw your car," Mrs. Briskin said. "What a surprise. Weren't you going to say hello? Were you just going to come and pick up what you wanted and then leave?" With her hand on the stair railing, she descended, a short, gray-haired woman, wearing a housecoat and slippers. He had not seen his mother in 2 or 3 years, and, as far as he could tell, she looked exactly the same. She was no more infirm or stooped or halting. She was as vigilant as always. He said, "I thought I'd take a camping trip. Come upstairs and say hello while you're here. There's some rolled roast left over from dinner. I read in the newspaper about your quitting your job at the station. Does that mean you'll be moving back here again to this side of the bay?" "I didn't quit my job," he said. He loaded the tent and the air mattresses and sleeping bags into the back of his car. "Is she still working there?" his mother asked. "If you want my opinion, you're a whole lot better off away from there, if for no other reason than because of her. As long as you're both working around each other, you're not really free of her." After he'd closed up the car, he went upstairs with his mother and had a cup of coffee in the long living room, with its carpeted floors and picture window overlooking the bay, its lamps and piano and prints on the walls. The living room was the same, except that the fir trees by the window had grown taller. In the evening darkness, the trees blew and rustled. Seeing the living room again reminded him of his first year of marriage, the year in which he had tried to get Patricia and his mother to come to some kind of terms. Pat, with her preoccupations, had been unaware of Mrs. Briskin, and his mother had responded with hostility. His mother could never accept a daughter-in-law who was not respectful. As far as he could tell, Patricia had no opinions about his mother. She enjoyed the house, its size and sturdiness, the large rooms and the view of the bay, and especially the garden. Patricia entered the house as if she were alone in it. The house was where he had grown up, and during the summer she liked to spend time out in the backyard, in one of the canvas lawn chairs, sunbathing and listening to the radio and reading and drinking beer. Patricia had one day come indoors in her bathing suit and thrown herself down to have a long talk with his mother. The marriage was already coming apart, and Pat had a lot to talk about. With her was a bottle of Riesling. Lying on the floor, on the rug, in her bathing suit, she drank and talked, while his mother, as the old woman related it, sat stiffly in a chair in the corner, disapproving and unsympathetic. Pat's erratic sorrow had gone on and on until finally the afternoon was over, and still she lay on the floor. The Riesling was gone, and she was either sound asleep or had completely passed out. His mother had telephoned him, and he had come and gotten her. He found her still in her bathing suit at 7 o'clock in the evening, still on the living room floor. On the trip back across the bay to their apartment in San Francisco, she had mumbled, and it had seemed funny to him. He could not work up the indignation his mother felt. The scene was the last between Patricia and his mother. As far as he could tell, Patricia remembered almost nothing of it. She thought that she had gone to sleep in the garden, by herself. "What about this camping trip?" his mother asked, seated across from him. "How long do you expect to be gone?" "I just want to get away," he said. "You're going by yourself? I noticed you took both the sleeping bags." His mother went on to recall the camping trips he had made with his father, the excursions up to the Sierras. She did not mention the trips which he and Pat had made together. "I have to go somewhere," he said, interrupting. "I have to do something." His mother said, "I wish you could meet some nice girl. He thanked his mother for the coffee and drove back across the bay to San Francisco. Parked before his apartment house, he opened the glove compartment and brought out all the road maps. But he was not going on a camping trip. He had already given up the idea. Putting the maps away, he drove in the direction of the station. An hour later, in a back room at Station KOIF, Jim Briskin sat sorting through the station's record library. On the floor was a carton half-filled with albums he was taking. Beside it was the carton he had brought back. On the table were his personal items: his bottle of Anison, nose drops, a hat he wore on rainy days, pencils and pens, letters he had saved that had arrived over the years, and odds and ends that he had stuck away in the desk at which he worked. Nothing at all of particular value. Frank Hubble kicked open the door from the broadcast studio. An LP of Gershwin tunes was on the turntable, 20 minutes of music. Hubble, lighting his pipe, said, "What are you doing?" "Taking home my stuff, bringing station stuff back." "Why don't you leave it all here? You'll be back in August." "Maybe not," he said. Tossing a dead match across the room to the wastebasket, Hubble said, "Patricia was in earlier." "That's why I'm in late," he said. "It was after 10 o'clock. "I don't mean during the day. I mean around 15 minutes ago. She was supposed to meet Bob, but he's out closing some deal. You know how he operates." "More used car lots?" Jim said. He could imagine Bob Posen still out, still chasing down contacts. "No, this is for a food account. She was all dressed up. I guess they were going out for a good time." Jim continued sorting the records from the cabinet. A Fats Waller disc slipped from his fingers, and he seized it and stuffed it into the carton. It was not his, but the hell with it. He wanted to finish and get out of the station. "Take it easy," Frank said. Puffing on his pipe, he strolled back into the studio and closed the door. While he was returning the station's records to the cabinet, a woman's voice said from behind him, "Hello, Jim." "Hi," he said, continuing to work. Pat entered the office. Her clothes, as always, were the best, he thought, noticing her shoes, her high heels, the straps at her ankles. She wore a rust-colored suit. A coat was over her arm, and on her hair was a small, simple hat. How red her lips are, he thought. Her figure was remarkable, but he was wise enough to recognize it from the bra ads. It was a professional figure, done with wire hoops and cones and straps. Too much pointing. Too much of an upward angle. "What time did you get up?" she said. "The next morning." "Around 10, he said. "I thought you should sleep, so I didn't wake you up. Did you see my note?" "No, I cleared out as soon as I could." Pat said, "I said in the note that you should go ahead and have breakfast. There was bacon and eggs in the refrigerator. And if you wanted lunch, there was a frozen chopped steak in the freezer." "To tell you the truth," he said, "I saw the note, but I wanted to get out."
"Why?"
She walked over beside him, and the hem of her coat dangled by his shoulder. Close beside him, her legs were smooth in that fine, regular manner. It was so gratifying to the touch. "Because," he said, "I was miserable enough as it was."
"You saw the write-up in the Chronicle?"
Pouring the odds and ends into the carton, he prepared to carry his possessions downstairs. "I'm parked in the taxi zone," he said. "I don't know how long I can get away with it."
"Are you moving out your things?"
"Pretty much." She followed as he lugged the carton along the hall to the stairs.
"Can I carry anything?"
"I can manage," he said.
"Use the elevator."
"Habit." He returned to the hall and, with the corner of the carton, punched the button for the elevator. "You going out tonight?"
"Yes," she said.
"You look good," he said. "When did you get that suit?"
"I've had it."
The elevator arrived, and Pat held the door aside for him. "Don't come down with me," he said.
"Why not?"
She was already in the elevator. She touched the button, and the elevator descended.
"I can help you with the car door."
When they reached the ground floor, she went ahead of him. He carried his load outside onto the sidewalk and to his parked car. Sure enough, a San Francisco cop was prowling at the license plate, considering it for a ticket. His motorcycle leaned by the curb, and he was already reaching his gloved hands toward his pad and pencil. "Station business," Jim said, balancing his load to get out his keys. "Records and scripts." The cop eyed him. "We always use this loading zone." As Pat opened the car door, he shoved the carton inside onto the back seat and went quickly around to the wheel. "This is a taxi zone," the cop informed him. "I'll be right out of here," he said, starting the motor. The cop shook his head and returned to his motorcycle. Jumping bodily on the accelerator, he roared off into the nighttime traffic and was gone. "I have to go back up," Jim said. He had forgotten his hat and Anison bottle.
"Will he be back?" Pat said.
"No," he said, shutting off the motor. "Not for a while." They went back up, this time walking up the flight of stairs. The building was cold and deserted, and the stairs were gloomy. Beside him, Pat put on her coat. He helped her with it.
"It's scary," she said, "this late at night."
She held on to the banister. He said, "I appreciated that, your letting me stay."
"I wish," she said, "I wish we could have gone ahead."
She stared down at the steps. Upstairs on the station floor, she caught Frank Hubble's attention through the glass window of the broadcasting booth. When he stepped out, she said,
"Has Bob been in?"
"No," Hubble said. "Not since you were in last." While Jim got his hat and Anison bottle, she telephoned Bob Posen's apartment. Hanging up, she said,
"No answer."
"He's out making money," Jim said. They went back down the flight of stairs. There, under the windshield wiper of his car, was a ticket.
"He came back," Pat said.
"He or one of his kind." Furiously, Jim tossed the hat and Anison bottle in with the other things.
"You should have moved it," she said, "when he told you to."
"How do you like that?" he said, trying to control himself. "You can't believe in anything anymore."
"You always hated to get a ticket."
He stuffed the ticket into his pocket. "Don't you? That's $10 shot. For nothing."
"Calm down," Pat said.
"Good night." He started into the car.
"Wait,"
she said hesitantly.
"I don't want you to go off like this. Why don't you take me across the street? That wouldn't do any harm."
He looked to see what was across the street. Most of the shops were closed and dark, and he dismissed them. But the Roundhouse Cocktail Lounge was open, and he realized that she meant it. "The bar?" he said.
"No," she said, changing her mind. "Let it go."
"Why not?" he said, taking hold of her arm. "Why not indeed?" he thought to himself, not letting her go.
"I better not," she said.
"If it was all right for me to stay with you the other night." He led her across the street. The traffic was held up at a light, and onto the far curb. "This certainly ought to be okay." She was nervous.
"It's so much like a date, as if you were taking me out again."
"I am," he said, keeping tight hold of her. Pulling away, she walked a few rapid steps. Her heels clacked on the pavement.
"I was just afraid if you drove, you might be under too much strain. You are, aren't you? You might hit something, and I'd blame myself."
"Suit yourself," he said, pushing open the doors of the bar. With all his willpower, he kept himself from looking back. The door swung shut, and he was inside, alone. The Roundhouse was a small, high-class bar where the drinks were mostly water and cost more than he could afford. He traditionally avoided the place. The booth seats were red leather with brass studs. Quite a number of women were at the bar, and they were all well-dressed. At the rear, a jukebox played dance music, strings and winds. The air was close. Everyone seemed to be smoking as well as talking. He stood for a moment, and while he was standing, the doors opened behind him, and Pat entered. Her face was pale. "Come sit down," he said, leading her to a booth and feeling inside him a terrible sweep of hope. He was in a state of tension, and as he helped her take off her coat, his hand shook.
"You're worked up, aren't you?"
she said, touching his wrist. "No," he said, seating himself across from her. "Just about to go out of my mind."
"Do you expect much out of this?" "Don't expect much. For my sake, please, don't make something out of this. I just want to sit here and have something to drink."
The waitress appeared. "What do you want?" Jim asked the woman across from him.
"Just order me something I can finish."
She placed her hands together before her, touching her purse. What she wanted was scotch or bourbon, and not a mixed drink, a sweet drink. Too many sweet drinks made her sick, and he remembered mornings when he had fed her tomato juice and soft-boiled eggs and dry toast until she was able to get out of bed and onto her feet. After he had ordered, he said to her, "Remember that New Year's Day we drove over to Sausalito to that joint out over the water? You lost your shoe. You sat down on the curb and wouldn't get into the car?" She said,
"I think I should call Hubble and tell him if Bob shows up to come over here."
"Don't play coy," he said.
"I'm not."
The drinks arrived, and she picked up hers.
"Do you think I am? Do you think I'm a tease?"
"No," he said.
"I am."
"Because of the other night?" He drank his own drink.
"It only made things worse. But it's as bad for me as it is for you. I feel terrible. I really wish I could die."
Already most of her drink was gone. When she was in a crisis, she drank, and this was a crisis for both of them. At each booth was a ceramic ashtray as large as a pipe tray, and gray. He inspected the one by his elbow. While he was holding it, he realized that Pat was on her feet.
"I'm going to go phone. Order me another."
She walked off, gliding forward without individual steps. Her coat was over her arm. The fall of it blended with her carriage, her upright posture. She lifted her chin and straightened the lines of her neck. At the same time, she seemed to know exactly where her feet were. He could not imagine her stumbling. "Get him?" he asked when she returned.
"Still no answer."
She picked up her fresh drink. "He's probably reading Looney Loop plugs." After she had gone deep into her second drink, she said,
"I want to show you something. It's a present."
Opening her purse, she lifted forth a small tissue paper package.
"For Bob. I got it in Chinatown."
She unwrapped a deity figure, which he had seen many, many times.
"It's a god. It brings luck."
She ran a nail across the stomach of the deity.
"What do you think of it?"
He had to tell her it was trash.
"Oh," she said. "Well, what do you think of this? Or maybe I shouldn't show it to you."
Another package was visible, but she put her hand over it, concealing it. "I'd like to see it," he said. With great deliberation, she unwrapped the package. "A bracelet," he said, taking it.
"Silver. Handmade."
She reached for it, and he wound it around her wrist. The bracelet slipped to the table. It was massive. He helped fasten it for her.
"Thanks," she said. "See the jade?"
Dull stones were set in the silver fret and scrollwork. "It's Indian," he said.
"India?"
she said doubtfully. "American Indian. Probably Navajo."
"What do you think of it?"
"You know I'm not much on that sort of stuff. Too heavy, too much bulk.
I like those thin hoops you used to wear."
Reaching up, he touched her ear. "Those earrings."
"They should have told me it wasn't Chinese," she said. "It was a Chinese store. The man was a Chinese."
She finished her drink, and he thought that she was beginning to get that fixed look. Her features were becoming rigid. She had worked hard all day, and she was too tired to cope with the situation between them. Too much, he thought, for both of them. His old tenderness sprang to life inside him, his feeling for her. He knew how unhappy she was, sitting here across from him. She could not leave, and, for her, remaining was unbearable. So she was drinking. "Let's go," he said, rising. He put her coat around her, handed her her purse, and, with his hands on her shoulders, persuaded her to get to her feet.
"Where?"
she said. In her fatigue and confusion, she was malleable. She wanted him to take charge.
"I should be over at the station. Suppose he comes and I'm not there."
"All right," he said. "We'll go back there." They left the roundhouse and recrossed Geary Street. As they passed his parked car, he saw that a second ticket was stuck under the windshield wiper. The hell with it. Upstairs in the station, he switched on the best amplifier and turntable. From the studio, Hubble watched, smoking his pipe as he fiddled with wires. Pat had withdrawn into a corner, taking no part in what he was doing. He plugged in a jack, closed a toggle switch, and as the tubes of the Bogan amplifier reddened, he rasped his finger against the diamond needle of the transcription arm. From the speaker, a gross "foof, foof" sounded, an enormous tumult. This was quality equipment. Over the years, he had helped assemble it. When he looked for Pat, she was gone. The door of the broadcast studio opened, and Frank Hubble said, "What's going on, pal?" "Nothing." "You going to hold forth here?" "No," he said. Over the years, he had come here and used the station's playback equipment. In a sense, it was his. Hubble said, "Of course it's fine by me, like old times, but I'll be locking up at 12, and you don't have a key anymore." He started to go through his pockets, and then he remembered that, of course, he didn't have a key. He had given it to Haynes. Without answering, he went searching for Pat. The door to the roof was open, and he stepped outside onto the rickety wooden catwalk. Pat stood leaning with her elbows on the railing, smoking a cigarette, and gazing across the roof at the lights and traffic of the street below.
"I wanted to clear my head," she said.
"Did you have that much to drink?"
"Yes."
She lifted her face.
"Before I came up here, before I ran into you, I was already over at the roundhouse."
"How many?"
"I don't know."
"You look all right," he said, his fingers on her neck, at the line of her chin. She said,
"I feel as if I'm walking along a long drain pipe, one of those pipes we used to crawl through when we were kids, bent over."
She drew away from him.
"You were going to play records for me, weren't you? Like we used to before we were married."
"May I?" he said.
"Do you have to? I just want to stand out here. I don't think Bob's coming. Please, you go ahead on in. I'll stay out here, please."
Going back in, he took an album from the record cabinet, an old Victor 78 RPM set of the Sibelius Symphony No. 7. Hubble had returned to the broadcast studio. He was reading a commercial into the boom mic. His voice was audible from the wall monitor, and Jim shut it off. The discs were in a manual sequence. He put side one on the turntable and lowered the arm. Now Frank Hubble was watching through the window of the studio. He scowled with disapproval. How wicked, Jim thought, to be playing records. A man trying to draw out and hold his own wife. The music, with its progression upward, its heavy quality of darkness and isolation, helped clear his mind. The weight seemed to pass from him into the music. The great structure of the music absorbed it and accepted it from him. So, he thought, he discovered at this late date that the stuff had a use. He got the music up loud enough to reach across the station, from one room to the next, out onto the roof where Pat stood in the darkness. At such volume, the music could not be evaded. Listening, he paced back and forth. He became restless, and suddenly he was afraid that no time was passing. The music had put an end to everything. As he was putting on the second record, Bob Posen appeared. "What a racket," he said. "I could hear it all the way downstairs. Isn't it getting over the air?" "No," Jim said, demoralized. In his mind, he had written Bob Posen out of existence. "Is Patricia here?" Entering the room, Pat said,
"Where have you been?"
"I was tied up, straightening out the Granny Goose potato chip material." He said it with anger.
Pat said, "I can't go out. It's too late. Take my word for it. You wouldn't want to be with me tonight. I've had too much to drink, and all I want to do is go home. We can go out some other time. She'll be there for at least a week, and if she's gone, we can see her when she's back this way."
She seated herself with her coat and purse on her lap. The drinks had begun to affect her outwardly. Her face was waxen.
"Just go off and leave me. Will you do that?"
Standing his ground, Bob said, "At least let me drive you home."
"Have you ever seen a woman throw up 9 drinks?"
Bob Posen left. "I'll see you tomorrow. Good night."
"Don't come near me," Pat said as Jim approached her.
"I know you," he said. He led her from the station and downstairs to his car. She walked slowly, step by step, her eyes on the ground. In the lobby she halted, and try as he might, he could not budge her.
"I'm scared," she said. "I'm too drunk to go with you. I know how you feel about me. Honest to God, Jim, I can't go with you. There's no point in talking about it. I mean it, and you know me well enough to know I mean it. And if I passed out, would you want me like that? That isn't what you want. I'm going to sit down here.
With care, she went to the lobby couch, the old, ratty, bedraggled couch, and stood beside it.
Go away, she said. In the name of Jesus Christ, leave me alone.
He walked out onto the sidewalk and then around the block, past bars and closed-up shops, until he reached the side entrance to the station's parking lot. By the long route, he came back to the McLaughlin building. In the lot was Pat's car, and she was trying to start it. The headlights were on, and with each turn of the starter motor, the lights dimmed to a feeble yellow. In the darkness, he watched her, feeling compassion for her. The car door was open, and she was crouched over the wheel, her arm resting on it. Her coat spilled onto the floor by her feet. She was crying. He could hear her where he stood. At last the engine caught, and the headlights flared up. Pat slammed the car door, threw the gear into drive, and drove directly into a car parked across from hers. The bumpers tangled with a grating, metallic shriek. The engine died, and Pat sat without moving, her hand over her face. Walking over, he saw that no harm had been done. Both bumpers were scratched, but that was all. Nobody would care. He opened the car door and said, "Sweetheart,
I won't let you," she said.
She was clutching the wheel, and on her face was the set, fanatic look that she got once in a long while. She was terrified of him and what she had done. Probably she thought she had demolished the other car. "Look," he said, "I don't want anything to happen to you. You can't drive. You'll kill yourself." She nodded. "Let me drive you to your place. I won't go in. I'll park you in front of the building and I'll leave you."
"How'll you get back here? You have to come back for your car."
"I'll walk, or take a cab."
"That isn't right,"
he said. "Then I'll send you home in a cab."
"Don't."
She caught hold of him, her fingernails dug into him.
"It's dark there. I want to be out somewhere."
Tears shone on her cheeks.
"It's awful living alone. I have to marry Bob Posen, don't you see? I can't stand living alone. I can't stand waking up in the morning alone and going to bed alone at night and eating alone."
Kneeling against the seat, he put his arms around her and pulled her to him. Kissing her, he said, "Then let's go to my place." For a moment, for the passing of one breath, she seemed to give in. Then, without pulling away from him, she said,
"I can't."
"What then?"
"I don't know."
Her voice was bleak. Tears fell onto his face. Tears rolled onto his nose, tickling him.
"I wish I hadn't let you stay with me the other night. I just can't stand it without somebody any longer."
"Somebody," he said, enraged.
"You, then. Oh, God. All right, take me to your place, and let's go to bed and get it over with. Hurry."
Jerking away from him, she scrambled over to make room for him.
"Let's go. Drive me there. I'm tired and I give up."
He sighed. "I tell you what," he said. "I have a couple of friends. Two kids." Her head turned, and she was looking at him. In the darkness, her gaze was fixed on him. He was aware of it, the intensity. "They invited me for dinner last night," he said. "Suppose we go over there and stay a while. Until you're sobered up, okay? They're nice kids. They've been in the station. You've probably seen them." Pat said nothing, but the struggle reached him, the sense of torment. "The girl's pregnant," he said. "She's 17, the boy's 18. They live in a broken-down flat on Fillmore. They don't have any friends, and their families aren't speaking to them. They don't have any money, and they'd like to see somebody once in a while." After a long time, Pat said,
"What are they like?"
Rallying, she said,
"Is she pretty?"
"Very pretty," he said. He was still kneeling against the seat, and now he stood up. He was stiff, cramped. "Very sweet, very bright."
"She doesn't sound very bright. She could have taken precautions."
For a time, she was silent.
"How did you meet them?"
"They came into the station. I took them with me when I went to dinner."
"What's their names?"
"Rachel, Art. Pat slid away until she rested against the far door. He gathered up her coat and purse and put them into her lap.
Just until I feel better, she said.
Okay. Relieved, he got in behind the wheel and started up the engine.
Did I damage that car? I never hit anybody's car before.
It'll live, he said. He backed her Dodge away and then drove from the parking lot.